People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Today on the program, Here With You, a mom's journey finding hope through her son's experiences with addiction and recovery. Kathy Wagner shares her story. And we'll hear from a Guelph, Ontario man who was homeless for a year and is now standing in solidarity with the city's unhoused community. Welcome to People First Radio. We're going to hear a story about addiction, hope, and healing. We're going to hear from a mom on the Lower Mainland who would do anything to help her son, including accompanying him on the first 5 weeks of a journey to China to study with Shaolin monks. Kathy Wagner shared her experiences during her son Tristan's addiction, recovery, relapse, and death in a memoir called Here With You. It also shares the hope and healing Tristan found in recovery, and how that hope and healing has impacted his family going forward.
Hi, I'm Kathy Wagner, the author of Here With You, a memoir of love, family, and addiction, and the mother of three grown children. My oldest daughter is 7 years sober in recovery. My middle daughter has never struggled with substance use disorder, and my youngest son passed away at the age of 21, 7 years ago, from the toxic drug supply.
Well, thank you very much for being here and making some time to discuss your story and to discuss Here With You. If someone was to maybe just read a one or two line synopsis of this from the publisher, they might think, oh, this is incredibly bleak, or this sounds very heavy. But there's also a lot of hope I found in this story. And I'm wondering if we can begin there today and you can tell me about maybe the hope.
Yeah. You know, how I like to explain the book, if somebody asks me what it's about, I say that it's the story of my experiences living through my son's addiction, recovery, relapse, and death, and the hope and healing that he found in recovery, and how he brought that to our family, and how it's affecting us now and continuing for generations to come. So there has been so much hope and healing that Tristan, through the course of his addiction and recovery, has brought to us. And I will be forever grateful for that. And that is fundamentally what the book is about, is how I was able to find healing through some very difficult times.
And it's very detailed, and it doesn't shy away from how hard this was at times, both just emotionally and, you know, in the moment of the things that were happening. What made you want to put this story on the page and share it with people in that very kind of intimate way?
Yeah, I've had a number of people refer to this book as being brave or unapologetic. And that's taken me back. It's a shame that we have to feel brave or feel like we should be apologizing for talking about the things that are really difficult in our lives. And being the mother of a youth in addiction is hard. And it's really, really hard when you're doing it alone, when there's nobody that you can talk about. And I think one of the absolute bleakest periods of my life was when Tristan was 15 years old and first in active addiction. And I had no clue what was happening, how I could help him, you know, what I could possibly do, or who I could turn to. And I didn't feel a lot of hope because I didn't see any path forward. And so what I am really hoping to do in this book is to be able to show people that you are not alone and there is a path forward and there is always hope. And even though it sounds fairly hopeless, knowing going into the book that my son does pass away from substance use disorder and the toxic drug supply, there is always hope for yourself, even if hope looks very different than you ever thought it would or ever expected it to. You know, there is always hope for our kids as long as they're still breathing. And when they're not, there is still hope for us to be able to find joy in our lives, to be able to laugh with our friends, to be able to have a life of purpose.
And that journey really comes across what you were describing of the change in you from when Tristan was 14, 15, and this was just getting started, to 5 or 6 or 7 years later, and what it was like day to day for you. Can you maybe tell me a bit about, I guess, the journey that you went on?
Yeah, you know, I am a problem solver by nature. You know, other people's problems are even better than mine to solve, you know. So when I first was faced with the fact of Tristan's addiction, and you know, and I'm talking about when I was really face to face with it, I could no longer deny it, which I had done for a period of time, like many people do. I just needed to solve that problem, and I could not find a way to get help to do that. I tried treatment centers, but nobody would take him because he didn't want help. I tried to take him to family doctors, but that wouldn't work because he wouldn't go. There was nobody in our healthcare system that could help Tristan because he did not want help himself. And as far as I'm aware, that is still the way that it is. There's absolutely no help to be had when a child is struggling with mental health disorders and substance use disorders, and they think they're just fine. So, you know, by the time he was 15, he had been kicked out of 3 different schools for drug-related charges. He had lost interest in the passion of his life, which had been martial arts. He was emotionally erratic and angry. And I didn't know what to do. So, you know, I did try to reach out for support. There, I wasn't finding any. I ended up taking him over to China to study Shaolin Kung Fu with monks over there, because that was still the one thing that sparked his interest. And that was hard enough to get him to go. But we were over there. I spent the first 5 weeks with him over there to make sure it was a good place for him. It was phenomenal. He really thrived in hard exercise, long days, fresh air, you know, clean food, and he, you know, came back to himself. So I stayed for 5 weeks and I left him there, and he stayed there the first time for a full year. So he was drug-free for that period of time. And I figured it gave him a sense of community. It gave him a sense of success. It gave him a chance for his brain to develop without the effects of chemicals and drugs. But it did not give him a chance to address the root of his addiction. So by the time he came home, he was out getting drugs and getting high before he had unpacked his bags.
And you talk about the root cause of the addiction there, and that's something that comes into the book maybe towards the end. I don't know, without, you know, asking you to go into too much detail or any more detail than you would want to, is there anything you can tell me or give people a sense of just maybe the role of trauma in all of this?
Yeah, you know, trauma is so interesting, because when I began writing this book, I was writing with the intention of showing that addiction can happen in any family, because addiction can happen in any family. There's no family that is absolutely immune to the possibility of addiction. What I realized as I was really writing through things is that we were not just any family. You know, we have addiction. You know, my children have addiction on both sides of the family, mine and their father's. To varying degrees, from very, you know, professional, high-functioning alcoholics to, you know, uncles and cousins who are homeless and on the streets. So addiction is something that genetically runs through our family. And I believe strongly that whenever there is that much addiction running through the family, there's also family dysfunction and trauma that is part of the family dynamics. And we just don't always recognize the trauma within our own families, because it's just the way it has been. It's just our lives. We don't really recognize it. And so for Tristan, he did grow up with some trauma and dysfunction at the family level. He had two parents who loved him dearly. You know, we did all that we possibly could for him. You know, we were involved parents, even though we were separated and split up. But there was absolutely some emotional dysfunctions there. And Tristan was a very sensitive kid, very empathetic, which is very similar to a lot of people who struggle with addiction. He felt everything deeply, and he took on every, you know, but he's feeling as his own. So he was more easily traumatized than other people who maybe experienced the same thing. You know, Dr. Gabor Mate likes to say that trauma is not what happens to you, but it's how we experience the things that happen to us. And Tristan experienced things very deeply. And once he entered into addiction, you know, living in addiction is a traumatic lifestyle. So what I found through the course of writing the book, you know, and writing was a healing process for me. It was a way I processed and began to understand things. I understood really how significant the role of trauma was, together with his genetic, I think, predisposition to substance use disorder and some personality traits that left him at risk. He, you know, had the perfect trifecta of being at risk.
You're listening to People First Radio. My guest is Kathy Wagner. We're talking about her experiences through her son Tristan's addiction, recovery, relapse, and death. It's a story she's told in the memoir, Here With You. A big part of this story is maybe shining some light on the recovery community, and that's such an illuminating part of the book is reading about everything that goes on there. Can you maybe tell me about your experience of that?
The experiences I will be forever grateful for. Like, it was a truly special time in my life, is coming into connection and being part of a community, of a recovery-based community, where people were there to support each other through it. And, you know, I had what I refer to as my own recovery community of people, of primarily other mothers that were doing their own recovery work. So when Tristan entered recovery, I joined his treatment center's parent group. And I joined it originally because I wanted to be the best mom I could be for Tristan in recovery and learn what he was doing. And I quickly came to realize that that's not what that group was about. That group is really about me learning how to live for me, separate from Tristan. And I hadn't realized quite how embroiled I was in Tristan's life until I realized that, oh my goodness, there's all these other moms out here who have children in addiction and they still have lives of their own. How does that even work? So my recovery process was around learning how to be my own person, in some ways for the first time in my life. And the other part of the recovery community that I was so happy to be connected with was through both my son and my daughter. So they were both in the New Westminster recovery community. And I have never felt, you know, so supported. You know, those were the people who, you know, if somebody was at risk, if somebody was relapsing, they would be there for them 100%. They would drive around, they would find them, they would collect them, they would take them off the streets, they would give them a place to stay, they would take them to a meeting, they would, you know, get them a phone, food, meals. They would do whatever they could to try to keep their friends alive when nobody else would help. And there's a lot of wisdom, I just have to say, you know, in the recovery community, there's a lot of wisdom that I think we all could benefit from. So I was very, very grateful to have been part of that.
I'm curious too, maybe about, I don't know how to frame this as a specific question necessarily, but the difference between when this experience was kind of first starting for you and you maybe didn't know where to turn to, and then in the later years when there was this whole recovery community, I guess, what are your reflections on the differences between those periods?
The difference was in my open-mindedness. You know, when I first reached out, I was connected with a support group through a local, you know, organization that was not a good fit for me. It was just a lot of people who were very lost in their child's addiction, and there was no hope and there was no talk of recovery in that group. At the same time, I was aware of things like Al-Anon and Nar-Anon support groups, but I had shut my mind to them because I had not heard anything that inspired me to reach out to them. I saw, you know, what is often represented in movies, like dark church basements with old people all griping about their, you know, past whatevers. It just seemed very dark. It just seemed very dark and not what I wanted. It also, I'd heard a lot about how 12-step groups and spiritual support groups are not evidence-based. They don't work, you know. So I stayed away from that. I didn't choose where I went into recovery. I followed my son, who happened to be in a 12-step abstinence-based treatment center, which was the right place for him at that time for a number of reasons. And so I walked into the 12-step approach to it. And I was absolutely astounded by how open-minded everybody was. You know, it was not, it didn't seem prescriptive or, you know, it just was loving. It was just filled with loving, helpful wisdom. And yeah, I think for me, it just goes to show you not to shut anything out until you try it, and to keep finding, keep searching for the group until you find one that fits, because there's a lot of options now. But I know a lot of people who turn their back on certain types of recovery because they don't think it'll work for them, never having experienced it. And I would just say, you know, try everything.
And I guess maybe worth highlighting that the big turning point was that this was something that Tristan wanted to do.
Yes. He, you know, and it is logistically impossible to get people into treatment unless they want to. So he was 20 years old when he decided to go into treatment, because at that point, he also had, you know, up until that point, martial arts had been a big passion. His other big passion was cooking. He went through culinary school. He was working in some of the best restaurants in town. He was working at Hawksworth for a while. That was his passion. That was his dream. He was going to be a chef. And he had gotten to the point where he could no longer keep a job past payday. And it was breaking his heart to end up getting the jobs that he loved, doing good work, and then feeling like he was letting everybody down because he could not go into work after payday for a period of time. So when that became clear and he was not able to make rent anymore, and at that stage I was finally ready to, it's like I could not have him home. He was too ill by that point. He just was not well. And so he agreed that he would get into treatment.
I think that kind of highlights, you know, it's a microcosm of, this is a story over several years, over several hundred pages. There's so much more detail in there than we could, you know, hope to talk about today. Are there any parts that stand out to you the most that you would most want to convey to people?
I think the two things would be, if the part that I want to convey is that there is always hope. When I entered the recovery community and I started looking at my own life, I realized that I am responsible for my life, regardless of what my child is doing. And as part of that, I was absolutely struck by the parts that brought joy, the parts that brought purpose, and the parts where you can heal yourself and how that continues to spread forth, right? It's like addiction happens to the whole family. Everybody is hurt by addiction, but healing and recovery can also happen to the whole family. And what happens to you spreads outward. So it really is about learning to care for yourself first and foremost. And by caring for yourself, then it positively impacts everybody around you.
This is People First Radio. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Kathy Wagner about her memoir, Here With You. It tells the story of Wagner's experience of her son Tristan's addiction, recovery, relapse, and death. It also shares the hope and healing that Tristan found during his time in recovery, and how that hope and healing has impacted his family going forward. You've also talked in the book a little bit about how you joined up with Moms Stop the Harm, and you've done a lot of media interviews. What are your thoughts on how you've experienced those issues handled by the media?
In general, media has its own message that it's trying to convey. So it will chat with the people who they think will spread their message, and they'll edit things out that don't. So for example, in the early days after I lost Tristan and I was being interviewed, I talked quite freely about recovery and how, even though Tristan passed away, recovery was not a failure for him because it had brought Tristan back to himself for 14 months. You know, the last 14 months of his life, he was sober for 12 of the last 14 months of his life, not consecutively. But he was able to make friends again. He was able to be part of the family again. He was contributing to society. And nobody can tell me that recovery is a failure just because the toxic drug supply killed him. But having said that, the media was not really interested in hearing about recovery. All they wanted to hear about was the toxic drug supply and would Safe Supply have helped him and the rest of it. Those are important topics. They need to be talked about, but they were not my story. And so it was frustrating when, you know, my messages of the importance of recovery got cut and dropped out. And it was just focusing on my son's death rather than on his life.
And you talk about as well that sometimes it can feel like there's almost this fight going on between the ideas of recovery or treatment for addiction and harm reduction, as if they, I don't know, they can't coexist or one needs to win out over the other.
Yeah, and that's still very much in play. And I've talked to people that are fairly, that are very active advocates on both sides of that. And fundamentally, it does come down to politics, and it comes down to different groups battling to get limited resources and funding. And the unfortunate reality is that when it comes to politics and fighting for money, you know, tearing the other party down seems to be a tactic that people are drawn to. So you've got the recovery community talking about how harm reduction doesn't work or isn't what's needed. You've got the harm reduction community talking about we don't need recovery because we need to save people first. And really, we are in such a crisis of addiction, mental health, and toxic drugs that we need an all hands on deck approach that can meet people where they're at, wherever they are, whether they need recovery, whether they need a safe supply, whether they need, you know, a safe place to use. People need help wherever they are at, and we need to supply, you know, a comprehensive service to help people, not just one side or the other. So yeah, that continues to irritate me when people get divisive like that.
And I think certainly what I took away, at least from the story, was how much both of these things, I don't know, would or did or could have played a role. Like, talking about how Tristan got a positive, helping people, being a huge part of a community life back for so long, thanks to what he did in recovery. And then, you know, it didn't feel like there was any kind of a spiral or anything. It was just so sudden, just him being gone because of fentanyl. And
yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. In more than you listen to media interviews and you hear slogans, but to read about it in a specific person's case is quite something. And I thank you for sharing that in the book.
I mean, it's tragic. It's tragic on so many levels. But what is, you know, addiction is not the kind of thing that can be cured completely and quickly and easily. There's obviously the mental health aspects to it. And Tristan, like many people who struggled with addiction, also struggled with depression, ADHD, and the intense cravings and emotional mood swings and despair that come with, I don't want to call it withdrawal, because he was addicted to stimulants and is more of a psychological withdrawal than the physical withdrawal you get through opioids. But the moods, there's a mood disorder associated with it as well through the early stages of recovery and not using drugs and learning how to regulate the emotions. It's hard. And I think at times Tristan put all of his effort into it. He worked as hard as he possibly could at his recovery, and he was buoyant through a lot of it. But he also, it was hard for him. And there were times he just felt really down and very down on himself. And his go-to for so many years when he felt that was to turn to drugs. And, you know, unfortunately, there were times in his recovery where that's what he continued to do.
You talked a little bit about maybe some of the politics involved. But I'm wondering, you know, if you were in charge, what changes you might like to see society make to address addiction or the toxic drug supply or any of that?
If I was in charge, I would be a little bit alarmed, because I don't know enough, but I do know enough to know I don't know enough, and which is more than what a lot of people I think in charge feel. What I really respect and what I think is the way to go are the things that do bring the comprehensive system of care. So things like what St. Paul's is doing now with Beyond, what's the name of that?
The Road to Recovery.
The Road to Recovery, exactly. So, like, I think that's a fantastic first step in being able to meet people where they are and not let them drop. The idea is that if they come to your attention because they ask for it or they are brought in from an OD, then they are immediately given whatever support they need in the moment and beyond. They're kept in, like, what do you need? Do you need treatment? Do you need medication? Do you need, like, what is it that you need? And you're actually treating them as a person with an illness, as opposed to throwing them back out on the street or turning them away to begin with. If you listen to Lisa Lapointe, who is the outgoing coroner, and her talks, or Bonnie Henry, anybody who understands it from a public health crisis in terms of what is needed from safer supply to keep people alive, because that is important. So I think we just really need to have, there needs to be help for people when they reach out, and it needs to be help in a form that makes sense to them, whether that is culturally appropriate treatment, whether that's a treatment that aligns with their, you know, morals and values and their sense of who they are, whether that's medically assisted treatment, harm reduction, safer supply, housing. We just need an all hands on deck approach.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh, and my guest is Kathy Wagner. She's told the story of her experiences through her son Tristan's addiction, recovery, relapse, and death in the memoir Here With You. Talking there about maybe changes we could make on a big systems level, I'm wondering if there are any changes you think individual people could make in maybe just their day-to-day life or the words they use, the things they say, that could make a positive change on this.
There is. And the first one I'm going to say is something that I talk a lot about, and it's the idea of telling our stories. We need to change the addiction mental health crisis. We need to change the toxic drug crisis. But I truly believe that most changes that we can make begin with ourselves. And there are so many of us who are living with addiction in the family, and we are doing it secretly because of shame and stigma and judgment being associated with addiction in the family. And we are not alone, right? So I think the first thing that we can do is acknowledge what it is that we're going through. I'm not saying everybody needs to write a book and share it with the entire world, but find that safe person that might start with, you know, a therapist or your cat or your dog or your neighbor or your friend. But it's amazing that the more stories get out there, the more people know they are not alone. And when you don't feel alone, when you start coming together as a group, that's when we have the power to change, right? That's when we have the power to heal as a group, and we have a power together to make changes. So I really strongly believe in the importance of telling our stories, getting the trauma out of us and in a way that will motivate us, that can actually cause momentum for change. And then, you know, beyond that, I think it's a lot of listening. I think we need to do more listening than jumping in with solutions. People who use drugs, whether they are doing it from substance use disorder or recreationally, have their own experiences, and they're often very different from what those of us who have not experienced that think it is. And I think that they are absolutely capable of leading the way in suggesting possible solutions and answers. So I think we need to be careful in trying to be prescriptive about what other people should do about their disorders of which we have had no experience.
Are there any resources that you might like to direct people to if they're looking for some support or help that maybe you found have helped you?
Yeah, for sure. Like I said, when my kids were in active addiction, I did find NARNON, which is the Narcotics Anonymous group for parents. I found that to be helpful. We now have, I was very much involved, I am still very involved with Healing Hearts Canada. I was a Healing Hearts facilitator, which is a support group for people who have lost loved ones to drug harms. And they also have their sister group now called Holding Hope, which is for parents and loved ones who have people in active addiction. So those are non-faith-based, non-12-step groups that are facilitated by peer facilitators who have shared similar experiences. So strongly recommend both of those offered through Mom Stop the Harm. Yeah, there's some good places to start.
Are there any passages from Here With You that really stand out to you that you'd like to share with folks?
I think I will read just a little bit about one passage towards the end where I'm struggling to come to terms with Tristan's addiction as being part of him. I think as so many of us as parents and as loved ones, we have a tendency to separate our children from the addiction. So their behaviors, you know, will say, oh, that's not him, that's his addiction. And that's true at some level, but there came a time for me where it became really important for me to integrate all of Tristan's experiences and recognize him as a whole. So I'll just read a little bit about that, if that's okay. For the first time, I acknowledged how much trauma Tristan had experienced. From our divorce, which had not been easy on anybody, and my five-year-old boy least of all, through him losing himself in his efforts to fit in and finding comfort in the escape of using drugs. In his short life, Tristan had been bullied, assaulted, and abused, and he had also bullied, assaulted, and abused others. There was so much that I had not or could not protect him from. So much of his pain I hadn't known or understood. I'd be haunted by guilt for the rest of my life, I knew. I closed my eyes and felt the soul-deep pain of knowing I hadn't been able to save Tristan from the nightmares I had feared for him, knowing that I had played a part in setting the stage for those nightmares through my own ignorance and dysfunction born of generations of family addiction. Hurt people hurt people. The phrase came to me as a whisper in my mind. Yes, I countered. And healed people heal people. In recovery, Tristan had begun to heal and share his healing with others. Three people had approached me after he died to tell me he had saved their lives by listening to them, encouraging them, and believing in them, and by sharing his struggle and sobriety with them. His sister, Jen, was one of those people, and who had inspired my own journey of recovery, if not Tristan. To heal, Tristan had needed to acknowledge his challenges, his actions, his trauma, to share them with others and to own them. With work and time, they might have been transformed from shameful secrets that pulled him down into strength that brought him compassion and insight to help others. Like alchemy, his pain and trauma might have been transformed, but they would never have gone away. They had been part of him. By denying Tristan's troubled soul, I realized I'd been denying his experiences, his budding strength, his wholeness. I'd been denying his hard work and healing.
Thank you so much for sharing that. There's maybe the climax of the book is this really beautiful moment where your daughter is getting married and it feels like Tristan is there.
Yeah.
And I don't know, when you were talking about the healing in that passage, it really made me think of that right there.
Yeah. And my granddaughter now is 10 years old, my daughter's daughter. And, you know, she's being raised by two parents who are sober in recovery and who are open about their struggles and are open about their challenges and their successes and are building an absolutely beautiful life. And all of that is only possible because of recovery. And for my daughter, recovery was made possible because of Tristan. So that is very much part of Tristan's legacy.
Is there anything else you'd like to bring to our conversation today?
No, thank you for having conversations and talking about these very difficult topics and, yeah, making sure that people's stories get heard. So thank you.
Well, Kathy, thank you so much for hopping on the call and taking the time to speak with me.
Appreciate it.
Kathy Wagner is the author of the memoir Here With You, which shares her experiences through her son Tristan's addiction, recovery, relapse, and death caused by fentanyl. It also shares the hope Tristan found in recovery and the lasting impact that it's made on his family.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
Greg Dorval has been housed for around a year after being unhoused for around a year. He's recently set up a tent outside the courthouse in Guelph, Ontario, as a form of civil protest in solidarity with those currently experiencing homelessness in the community.
My name is Greg Dorval. I was homeless here in Guelph, Ontario, for a year. I feel like I won the lottery getting housed a year ago. It was one of those things that just happened to have something at the right time a existing roommate that he and I were a good fit, and it's been a blessing to get housed, but you know, it's been at the same time very painful to see folks that, you know, people I was lining up last winter outside behind the emergency shelter. We, you know, line up for a couple hours to wait for the doors to open through the bitter cold. And, you know, I learned about what it means to be a member of this community through that experience, especially when it's freezing cold out and the wind is whipping around in the dead of winter, and it's dark, and you really, you know, you got to wait an hour or more, or 2 hours, whatever it is, even in the last 5 minutes, waiting for someone to come and open that door. It can drain the life energy out of you.
Can you tell me maybe a bit about what your experience was like finding housing and getting that housing?
Like I said, I feel like I won the lottery. Things fell in place quickly for me. And so I was staying at the emergency shelter in Guelph from... So I was homeless for almost a year. I lived in the woods for a good chunk of that. I came back to Guelph in early December the year before. Oh, time flies. And I'd been living in the woods on some property up kind of in northern Ontario near Huntsville. I've been experiencing chronic pain for the last 4 years, which has been an ongoing struggle and mystery to figure out what's going on. But at that time, really no answers forthcoming. But I knew that with the symptoms I was having, it was going to be a real struggle to get through the winter living out in the woods just on my own. So I decided to come back to Guelph and figure things out from there. But I ended up, you know, I had to live on the streets, sleep in homeless shelters, find, you know, creative ways to just continue being me during my circumstances. But the housing part was, you know, through the emergency shelter system, I had been previously connected with a social worker at CMHA. Through them, they connected me, and through the emergency shelter system, I was connected with a housing worker who, encouraged me to look for places on my own, but also just came up with this one option at one point in late January of last year, about a year ago. And it worked out. My roommate, he's also, he had been looking for a number of months to find a good fit for a roommate, and it's a struggle. I even get the kind of the landlord's perspective. I get the general public's kind of perspective that, you know, a lot of people who are on the streets, for whatever reason, they're hard to be housed in a way that is stable. Right? People get housed at different kind of levels along the kind of continuum of housing stability, but they end up, it's like a revolving door, right? It's symptomatic of the problem that's trying to be solved, in the sense that it's what, whatever the why is that they're homeless or whatever, is also the most significant factor in why they struggle to maintain stability, even if they are housed. I feel privileged to have been given a life, through my early years that set me up for success later on in life. I definitely have an advantage over a lot of people I've met in that regards.
Are there any maybe parts of, from your experience when you were living homeless, that you think most people don't realize or don't have any idea about that you want to share?
Yeah. Everyone at one point in their life, I'm sure, has woken up in the middle of the night and had to pee. Well, I'll tell you. Yeah. If you wake up in the middle of the night, wherever you're sleeping, whether it's on a bench, a tent, if you're lucky, doesn't matter, man. You got to pee, man. Try and find a place where you can pee in the middle of the night that's, you know, not you know, out in the face of public, whoever may be awake. Man, that's a challenge. Just, you know, managing to get up and, you know, try to be a little bit, you know, human about going to the bathroom in the middle of the night, or any time of the day. Man, try it. Just like, you know, people that, but so my struggle, here's an example. So my struggle, I've been housed for a year, right? And I've been down here camping on this beautiful courtyard surrounded by stone walls behind the Ontario Supreme Court building here in Guelph. And, you know, it's been bringing back things that I'd forgotten that I struggle with, man, because I've gotten into this kind of daily routine being housed. I'm only back there kind of for like an hour or two, maybe in the middle of the day each day. But man, like what a difference it makes to be able to close the door behind me and feel like I have a safe place where I can just like process kind of my, you know, I could kind of let my needle, allow it to kind of veer towards the parasympathetic rest and digest kind of mode. You need to feel safe for that to happen primarily. And how do we expect anyone to succeed when they don't have a second in any day? Some of these people, it's been decades since they've had a moment where they feel safe. That both saddens me deeply, but also really fuels my drive to help.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm speaking with Greg Dorval, who I reached in Guelph, Ontario. He's been housed for around a year after experiencing a year of homelessness. Recently, he set up a tent outside the courthouse in Guelph as a form of civil protest in solidarity with the community's unhoused population. What do you think we could do as a society, different levels of government, to address the situation of people experiencing homelessness?
I think it's got to start outside government. I think it's got to start just with people in general. I hope that people can start to see anyone they pass by. You know, obviously, we need to exercise caution in life, obviously. But, you know, just anyone that you see anywhere, you know, recognize that they're a human struggling, suffering, going through life just like you are, just like I am. And, you know, here's kind of maybe where the stoicism comes in. This is a practice of, you know, whether it's through like a mindfulness practice of meditation or whatever, but finding, you know, practicing, you know, finding that, you know, the public, the general public, you know, the majority of the general public has those opportunities to feel safe and, you know, give themselves that rest and digest kind of thing. Not to say that it should be only those people who have a safe place at home, but everyone, think, just when you look at one another, just like practice saying, oh, you know, that's a brother, that's a sister, that's, you know, we're all family, and start seeing everyone as just, you know, we're all human out here trying to survive in whatever this is that we're in, this crazy, whatever. It doesn't matter if it's a hallucination or a whatever. Like this is what we've got. So let's be there for one another. I've seen evidence. This is a new insight that I'm sharing, that we're stronger together than we are apart. We're stronger together than anyone can be alone. And why is stronger? Maybe, you know, if people, as you see people as you go through your trip, maybe a practice of wondering or noticing when a situation that is maybe triggering, if the immediate reaction is divisive, then just notice that and then, kind of take it with you as a process. Oh, well, how could I be maybe, less divisive on that and more, at least maybe allow myself to wonder what that person might be struggling with in this moment, or accept that that person is struggling at all. And it becomes, everything, solid foundations take time, and it's just little bits of practice, but it's the first, it's got to be the practice of noticing your own reaction and what it is you're reacting to. That, that's a start. Now, from there, I hope that, as we start to see everyone, one another as, as humans, as brothers and sisters, as that starts to grow, I hope that now let's work together on, and government included. The government is a set of systems the systems are predominantly played out by humans, right? So we look at the humans and we hate the system, but we direct our anger towards the humans. And it's not the people that we elect. It's not the people that work for the government that I hate, or that anyone I think should hate. I hate the state of the systems right now. I hate the inefficiencies, the ineffectiveness. I hate that the governments spend tens, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars on figuring out a best solution for something only for a new party, whatever, to be elected, or something happens and it's now we throw that out. This is important now. And let's work together. It doesn't have to be us versus government at any level. Just work together.
This is People First Radio. My guest is Greg Dorval. He's speaking about his experiences while homeless in Guelph for around a year. Can you tell me maybe about some of your experiences of community while you were experiencing homelessness?
Yeah, let me share a story, and I'm going to do this without, I'm going to do my best. I think I can do this without, it's hard to share stories, but I've got to be sensitive to not identify people, right? Because I care about their privacy more than I care about sharing a good story. It was one night, one of the first probably couple weeks that I was staying at the emergency shelter. And like I said, I actually form a line for 2 hours. So we congregate in the back parking lot for a couple of hours and just hang out. I won't get into that. one night, the first couple of weeks that I was staying at the emergency shelter, I was out back, and it was, I was the fifth person there. So we tried our best to, when it was time to get in the door, to actually form a line in the order that we showed up. And that was always a challenge, because it's so cold, and you've been staying there for hours, and man, does that cold ever creep into your bones when you're standing there for so long with that only thing is that door opening. That's all you care about, right? So it's hard to find the compassion or energy to deal with conflict. So I was about the fifth person in line this one, and the door had opened. The first couple of people had gone in, There's another guy there who was wearing the exact same coat as me, and it was about my height. And I guess he had told this other guy that he could take his place in line. And the other guy thought it was me who had said that to him. So I went to go in the door, and he got like, he's like, what, you know, got up in my face. Like, what? It turned into, it was like very close to turning into a fight. I love this guy, by the way. He's awesome. He never backs down for a fight. It doesn't matter. There's a respect there for like someone like, I don't like violence. I don't condone it. But man, well, you mean someone who's got this tenacity after decades of life, it's just a testament to how people get knocked down so much in life, and this guy, that doesn't matter. He doesn't care if he's getting knocked down, and he's going to be right in there fighting, and he'll get right back up. So he wasn't going to back down from the fight, and neither was I, but I found the strength within me to de-escalate a bit, and somehow I noticed it was, I don't know how it came to me. I noticed that it was this other guy that had the same coat in it. I just felt like, are you confusing me for this guy? And it just diffused the situation. And then I went in, and then like, I don't know, half an hour later, like everyone was, you know, we got coffee when we get in, as you get in, right? And it takes like an hour to get everyone in. There's only 30 of us. And then, you know, I got coffee. So it's like a half hour, an hour later, this guy walks up to me and he's like, I'm really sorry that I thought it was you. And I'm like, you know, sorry. He's like, he's just genuinely, he's so grateful that it didn't turn into a fight and that it was de-escalated and it sorted out that way. And I saw it in his face. This is the guy who does, he'll fight anyone, man. He doesn't care, right? And he just, I could see it. His thank you, his gratitude was so genuine. And man, that was like over a year ago, man. That was early December 2022. That's a long time ago. And that sticks out in my mind as like I knew in that moment, like, wow, like, every single one of these guys worth fighting for. And these guys are off. These are like, you know, that's an example of humanity right there. That's like, the public doesn't see that. And, you know, that's what I mean by like, with just little bits of like shining hope that I've seen and that continue to fuel me. But there's also a lot of that the public does see, and they're right about the bad stuff. But I just think that as a society, we've been wrong about the approach we take around how to effectively and helpfully deal with the bad stuff.
Is there anything else you'd like to bring to the conversation today?
I really want to thank the people of Guelph, everyone, like the community I've come to love, right? The kind of homeless and at-risk community, you know, my brothers and sisters, not just them, but men. I felt over like the last couple of weeks, just didn't, I can't describe it. I can't tell you, it's, you know, this is not like a statistical data driven analysis, but just from my gut, I feel like the energy is changing a bit around Guelph, that, you know, that there's been a lot of warmth received, not just from me by others, but from so many members of our community. But this can't be it's in the spotlight, so let's show our love. But now when something else is in the spotlight, that peters out. That's not what this is for me, right? The challenge is to like bring attention to this, but for a purpose, right? Like to drive change. So it's got to be this continuous, it doesn't have to be this level of attention for like years. I hope it's not. But I hope that it starts to, the biggest thing is, I think I've noticed maybe like little tiny bits of conversation as a people passing by here and there. It sounds like people are opening up a bit and talking about kind of relatable experiences, no matter who they are. And, you know, that's the thing that has inspired the most hope in me, is that I think I'm kind of getting a sense that people are talking more and kind of, looking at, you know, homeless, the at-risk, those suffering from addiction, I hope with a little bit more compassion and with kind of somewhat kind of relatable stories, even if it's only one thin thread that makes it relatable. Right? We're all human, and to have kind of seen that and felt that kind of energy change over the last couple of weeks, and that, thank you to Guelph. That's been awesome. My heart is beating right now. I really appreciate all of you.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Hey, thanks so much, Joe.
Greg Dorval speaking to me from Guelph, Ontario. He's been housed for around a year after being unhoused for around the same amount of time. That is it for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Don't forget, you can check out these and other past interviews on our podcast feed. Just search People First Radio. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.